This is Japan Baseball Weekly, the only English podcast covering all 12 NPB teams. And now, your hosts, John E. Gibson and Jim Allen.
Hi, and welcome to the Japan Baseball Weekly podcast. It's for the week of May 1st. I'm John Gibson, and with me on a Saturday night for me and a Saturday morning for him is my partner, Jim Allen. How you doing, Reno man?
Yeah, Reno man. It's like Peking man, like they unearthed me or something.
Or Repo man. I was going for.
Yeah, I'm different time zone man today, but I'm good.
You don't sound good, but yeah, I'm glad you're up early and you look well. And
yeah, I looked well because it's really weird for once to be in the middle of a baseball season and not be watching baseball for a week. Although I did figure out how to get Shohei Ohtani on the TV when he was blacked out the other day and then watch him give up 5 runs in an inning. Second, the streaming kicked onto the big TV.
Oh gosh, yeah, the one pop fly home run, and then wait a minute, I wasn't supposed to throw that there, and you weren't supposed to hit it.
So yeah,
I did see that, but yeah, good. Well, stealing cable, that's always gonna.
Well, it was not stealing cable. It's called It's called 1 month free offer.
Gotcha. I know that guy.
for the A's network up here, but because MLB blacked out, you know, places in the neighborhood of Anaheim, and Reno's kind of in the neighborhood of Anaheim.
Right.
if your neighborhood allows for 5-hour, you know, it allows for 15-hour drives.
Yeah. If you're an F-15 jet, yeah, it's in the neighborhood.
got some of those up here. We got jets flying.
Yeah. Well, I know there's a lot of nothingness out there, but let's get to baseball. On this week's show, we've got David McKinnon of Seibu as the guest. We're going to discuss Munetaka Murakami's slump. We're going to go rocking with Roki and look at the top performers of the first month plus. And we're going to handle some high heat. So let's start swinging.
Clearing the bases.
Okay. Well, I actually was at the ballpark and it wasn't the WBC, and reporters were allowed to pretty much go where they wanted on the field. And it was like the Twilight Zone.
I was so jacked when I had my interview.
Well, John went and he did all the nice things, you know. He went all the nice things, and I went in with an attitude like somebody stop me, you know. John was like, you guys can make this easier, and I'm going, just try it. Okay. So anyway, one of the head of the new head of the Seibu Lions PR guy came up to me and asked what was going on. And it wasn't like I was the elephant in the room or nothing. There were reporters all over the place, but you know, we stand out.
Mm.
And he came up to me and asked basically asked me what I wanted and how he could help.
I told you they're nice. I told you they're nice.
Yeah, and this guy, like, I guess he knows about baseball, but he actually knew me because he'd seen me in my day job at the office when he was visiting, when he was the PR chief for Seibu Holdings.
Okay.
Like 3 or 4 years ago. And I said, is that different from what you're doing now? He said, yeah, night and day. So, which is probably a good thing. He seems to enjoy this more than he did the Seibu Holdings PR stuff. And I said, yeah, I wanted to talk to David McKinnon and I wanted to talk to Kona Takahashi. And he says, well, we'll get Kona, you know, if he comes around, maybe, but we'll get him if, you know, sooner or later. And here's David. And if you want to talk to him, he's right here waiting for you. So go do it. So I did. And David is as you'll hear on the chat, he's just a very pleasant guy, and we talked a little bit about his travels and the reasons for being in Japan. So let's just have a hear of what he had to say.
You've always done really well with the strike zone, and Japan's strike zone is you know, you're coming into a new context.
Yeah, yeah.
How has that adjustment been?
I think for the most part they're pretty good umpires, so mm-hmm. I mean everyone's gonna make mistakes. Mm-hmm. It's a big situation, obviously, it's a little different. You can't really argue because you don't know the language. So, but no, I haven't really had any problems with too many strikes. So, I think it's been really good. And the umpires are pretty accurate. I think it's honestly smaller up and down. Mm-hmm. Maybe.
Yeah.
Could be a little bit wider, but I think you can protect against the side to side. It's hard to protect up and down, so yeah. I think it's a little more hitter friendly.
I think you got a ball or two at the top.
Yeah. So yeah, it's definitely a little different than the States.
Okay.
But I think it's been good. I think the hardest part is adjusting to just new pitchers.
Okay, yeah. And getting the timing on all these different.
Yeah. Yeah, different
two steps,
kicks.
One steps, circle steps.
Yeah. So that's definitely a little tough too, because some guys have a bunch of different. I think a lot of Japanese pitchers, they're masters at screwing your timing up. You know, they have a bunch of different pitches and they have a couple different leg kicks to throw those different pitches with. So
even with the same pitch,
it's just different. So you definitely, I think my type of move, rather than like a big leg kick or something, my move's a little simpler. So. I think it's easier to be on time because it's a simpler move.
Okay.
There's not as many. I don't go to sequence too much in order to get my foot down on the ground. It's close to the ground, so that makes it a little easier. But yeah, no. Other than just seeing new pitchers, that's kind of the toughest part. I think.
Okay. Let me a couple of before I get into some other, I guess, more details. What were your expectations about Japan that maybe have played out exactly the way you wanted? Maybe some was like didn't quite.
Yeah. So expectations coming in was like baseball wise. I don't really have two. I have goals, obviously, but that'll be end of the season, kind of reflecting, but.
But how about Japan's game?
Japan's game in general?
In the way you're in, because obviously every day is learning.
Yeah, it's learning. Just different positioning. Obviously, you can shift, but they don't shift, you know? So that's one thing that was a little different. Playing in a little bit more, even at first base.
Yeah.
At third base, you play in when someone's faster, you're going to bunt. But there might be one guy in an order in the U.S. where here you might be in half the game, you know, so that's a little different. And then if it's guys really fast, even at first, you're playing in to prevent a bunt, so that's a little different too. The small ball is I expected it, but it is like you'll bunt in the second inning sometimes, you know, to get a run. So you're playing for one run rather than like the big inning, which is a little different. So I expected it, but it is different than baseball in the States, you know.
What things have been hard for you, maybe more that are still puzzling you, or obviously the pitcher's motion, like you said. Is there anything else about just the way the game's played that you're still thinking, okay, I'm going to figure this out before the end of the year?
I think honestly, at the beginning of every season, I'd start a little bit slower in general.
Okay.
I mean, if you look back on honestly all my starts, they've been slower. Last year, I think I hit 200 in April in AAA. The year before, I didn't start that good in AA. And I think it's just because you're seeing, like, it was my first year at that level in AA, seeing new pitchers. First year at the level in AAA, you're seeing new pitchers. So, yeah, I just think typically, like, if you're seeing new people for the first time, it's hard to come out the gate and hit 350 or 300, you know. So I think the more pitches I see, the more success I'll have. Nothing's too puzzling, I don't think. Like, I'm seeing the ball really well. I just need to get used to the pitchers, I think. Right. Yeah.
Well, I think, obviously, it seems like the last few years, every year has been like this. You've been in a new situation.
Yeah.
And last year you were you were in two different AAA teams and two different MLB teams. And it must be really maddening not getting the reps in the same context.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely tough. I think the toughest part about, like, in AAA last year, I'd only played with, like, one guy on that team.
Right.
In AAA.
Okay.
Stefanik was the only guy I played with. So I was kind of meeting all new people at that point. And then when I moved up to the big leagues, I had never been at a big league spring training. So I didn't really know any of the guys. Like, obviously, you know, like, Trout and Ohtani. But, like, you don't know them personally.
Right.
So you're kind of meeting a bunch of new people and having to get comfortable quick again. And you're facing pitchers that you've never faced before. So it's definitely tough, but I think it's helped me a lot coming here.
Because
now you're in a whole new situation in a new country, and you're having to face new pitchers for the first time, but also you have a bunch of new teammates that most of them don't speak your language. They speak a little bit,
yeah.
And super friendly, and they're fun to be around and awesome guys. But yeah, it's just a little different, you know. So I think the last couple of years have prepared me for.
Have you played winter ball at all?
No, I have not.
Okay,
no.
So this is sort of your winter ball.
Yeah, this is new. Yeah, this is winter ball for me. So this is definitely a little different.
But you got a lot of people, you know, when I started, you know, back before they invented fire, when I was reporting on Japanese baseball. They had two guys on the entire roster, two imports, period.
Yeah.
And if you wanted another one, you had to cut one.
Okay.
So the network, you know, in the States, it was really small of people who went to Japan and came back. And now I'm going to be in Reno in a couple of weeks, and I'm wondering who in that game has played in Japan who I know.
Yeah. Or who's going to eventually play in Japan, you know?
Or all the scouts. There's like three scouts who live in Reno, so it's going to be old home week.
Yeah.
But you know, Matt Davidson was all, I don't know if you were on the same team.
Yeah. We were played against each other, and we were on the same Las Vegas team last year.
Right, and there was somebody else, too.
Sheldon Noisy,
right. Yeah, he's making he was making a bet. I don't know
what... He was hitting... pretty good in the first week or so. I don't know. I didn't check.
The second week, he hit, I think, two or three home runs, and he really hit.
Oh, really?
Oh, nice. Against the Giants here, which is this place where the ball really...
the ball goes a little bit.
Well, it's got no power alleys.
Yeah.
It's really shallow.
Yeah, and then it gets deep in center, and it seems like it just goes straight out.
Yeah, so if you've got power to straight away to the straightaway left and right, you're in good shape.
Yeah.
So... what's been kind of the most fun you've had here? Obviously, you're in a situation to get a lot of reps this year.
Yes, which is awesome.
When's the last time you had 400 plate appearances with the same team? Never?
Probably 2018.
Okay.
Yeah, so like 2018, I was in low A and then moved to high A, so I probably got 500 plate appearances that year, but double A, it was a shortened season with COVID,
right.
But I still had, I probably had 400 plus appearances, but last year was tough.
I know people who come here, they say, this is the first time I ever got 400 with one team.
Yeah, well, it's tough to, like, go up and down and up and down. You don't ever get comfortable. Like, I was hitting really good in AAA last year, and then you get moved up.
But
then you're kind of on the bench. Spot starts. And, I mean, that's just the business, but it's hard. It's hard to perform it with that way. So.
How long had Japan been on the radar? Was it fairly sudden?
I needed to debut before I could. You need to debut really before you head over. So, it was always a thought. My agent a couple of years ago, had always mentioned it. So it was always like in my head. But obviously, when you do debut, you're like you're
who's
thinking
your agent?
Like. Right now, it's Sohail Shapar. He's actually a connection. He was. Scott Matheson's agent.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's, I think that was the main connection, how I ended up here.
Okay.
So, yeah, that was a big one, but.
So this year it was going to be like more of the same?
This year, well, I got non-tendered.
Oh, okay.
So I kind of just was a free agent. I could do what I want.
Big chance.
Then it was easy. Yeah, it was an easy decision at that point. So once I got the opportunity, I wanted to come out here.
So I just want to thank you for joining us on the podcast.
Sure. Yeah, thank you for having me.
Okay.
Well, thank you, David. It was a real pleasure, and it probably made me feel better than anything, just having that kind of normal conversation with a player. I had a few in Osaka. Sounds like I came off the wagon or something.
Yeah, man.
I had a few chats.
We are coming off the wagon. We all are.
It is very much, although in a positive way, you know.
Well, it's like it's the attitude you get when you see people not wearing masks and you're saying, oh, I don't have to wear a mask either. It's like, you know, you said Twilight Zone or something. It's like an out of body experience that's happening, but it's real. You know,
it's the end of prohibition is what it is.
I like it. I love it.
So, okay. Well, John, what did you want to comment on?
Well, I thought this was fantastic. And the main reason why is right off the bat, I'm just like, first of all, I'm falling in love with all the Cebu people. And to hear you tell that story about the PR guy coming up to you and assisting you instead of what a lot of teams' PR people do, which is push you back and send you away as quickly as possible.
And teams, and if any of you teams are listening, you know who you are.
You are, yeah. So that's great. And I'm just falling in love with the Sable Lions organization and the people. But as long as we don't have to see those ugly Sable blue uniforms, the Kiyohara era ones, I guess I can fall in love with them.
But those powder blue ones?
Oh, they're not powder blue. That's the thing. They're just kind of, I don't like that blue. And it doesn't look good on baseball field. But anyway, as long as they don't do that again, I could fall in love with them. But anyway, the thing I love right off the bat is you're talking about the strike zone. Mm-hmm. And as many of these interviews that we have done the past 12 plus years, including the interviews that we did for just stories, I really never heard a player get into, and I wouldn't say David got into deep detail, but I never really heard anyone talk about the strike zone in terms of how the umpires are adjudicating it top to bottom and side to side.
Mm-hmm.
We've just heard complaints, you know, that's not a strike. That's 6 inches off the plate. That was at my feet. That was over my head. Or the umpires they're all over the place, or they're erratic. And so we've heard, you know, that calm down a little bit, especially since Robert Whiting's books talking about how the strike zone was just not fair for a lot of foreigners early on. And we've seen that kind of,
and intentionally not so.
Right. And we've seen that dissipate over the decades and become more of a standard operating procedure for everyone involved out there. And that I really appreciate. So to hear David talk about, first of all, the umpires being very fair, that was just beautiful to hear. But that top to bottom aspect of it, I absolutely love this description of the strike zone, because the side to side can make a difference. But I think hitters can maybe make a decision on whether to swing or not earlier, you know, split seconds earlier when it's side to side. Top to bottom, you're not sure when. A lot of times the ball drops the last third of the area to the plate. You're already starting your swing, and it's hard to decipher whether you're going to have a chance to hit a ball or a strike. And sometimes you let it go, sometimes you swing at them. So I think the top to bottom kind of impacts batters a lot more than the side to side. I think they can decipher that a little bit faster side to side.
No, I think you really hit it right there. A nice compact swing, because the difference is, especially with fastballs, which aren't fastballs and 12 to 6 curves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if the umpire is going to call that thing at the letters, you're going to be in trouble if you don't really have a good read on where the ball, you know, where the ball is going to be called.
Correct.
Hard enough because you don't, especially with pitchers you don't know, and how much is this thing going to drop. So,
yeah.
But yeah, I had seen that. So I'll let you get back to your.
Okay. So I thought that was huge, because I it made me really think about how guys are going about trying to, guys who strike out a lot, like a Chunichi Dragons player in particular, just has no clue where the ball is going, whether it's going side to side or top to bottom anyway. And then another thing that I think we need to pay attention to, and this was kind of the backdoor slider, I think, of this chat, was the positioning factor David spoke about in terms of playing in a lot. And it's something that we don't notice because we watch. That's why you have to go to games. I think it's good to look at a guy and say, oh, man, you know, that coming off the bat, you know, you're watching on TV and you say, coming off the bat, that guy should have gotten that ball. It wasn't hit that hard and it wasn't. You know, it wasn't in the hole or anything. How come he couldn't get it? Oh, that guy's got no range. And then you hear David talk about the fact that they're playing in a lot more than he's used to. And so we don't know all the time where these guys start and where they start in relation to when the ball arrives. We have to get different camera angles if you're not at the park. If you're at the ballpark, you can see. And I always try to tell people who are new to baseball, even the guys who think they know a lot about baseball, watch the feet. We spend so much time looking at above the waist and what's going on with the pitchers and their arms and the batters and their swings and all that stuff. Watch the feet. The feet will tell you so much about what's going on out there. And once you go to the park, you can see if the guy is moving quickly with his feet, and if he's going, if he's taking false steps, if he's not going the right direction, or if he's fluid with his movements and all that stuff. You can see it when you're out at the ballpark. So to hear David talk about how they're playing, it reminded me of the Bobby Scales interview that we did when he said, you know, they had me playing in over when Yu Darvish was pitching when he was with the Nippon Ham Fighters. And they said, he said they, the team had him pulling over as if somebody was going to pull any of Yu Darvish's fastballs. And he thought that, you know, left-handed batter, and Bobby was playing second base. And he said, no way they were going to pull any of his pitches in the hole, but they told him to play, you know, closer to the hole in between first and second. So that positioning aspect of what's going on and how these players go about it, you know, we can't just say, oh, you know, that ball got hit and that player should have gotten it. There's so much more that goes into it. And I thought that was the backdoor slider of this interview.
Yeah, I thought that was good too. And I thought, you know, explaining the discomfort, that level that is there, the strike zone, really, actually, it's something I've sort of seen, and I saw a great description of this, although it wasn't really about an NPB strike zone. It was because the NPB data is one of those things like, well, we don't want you really to know too, you know, it wouldn't be a good thing if fans knew too much, kind of NPB's thing. or a Hiroshima Carp thing, you know, it wouldn't be good if our players knew too much. But they had a seminar, they had a stats competition, a statistical analysis competition and seminar on statistical analysis in Japanese baseball in March 2022. And I went primarily because A, I thought it was cool, and B, because Hideki Kuriyama was going to be there. He's one of the participants.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember if he was one of the participants, but he was in attendance there, and we talked to him afterwards. And one of the presentations given by teams of college and university students. And one of them talked about the difference between MLB's strike zone, which they can document through StatCast, and the industrial corporate level baseball in Japan, which they could get the data from the Corporate Baseball Federation.
Mm-hmm.
They can't get it from NPB, but they can get it from amateurs.
Right.
And it basically documented the strike zone the Japanese, I will say Japanese players get used to, Japanese hitters get used to. And it's basically about the MLB strike zones is quite a bit different up and down than the Japanese strike zone, especially not at the bottom, but at the top.
Mm-hmm.
And you could see that. And I thought that was really interesting. And I guess the other one was talking about, you know, the ordinary, you know, what it's like to be in Japan and the need to come here and get reps. Of course, I fed him that one, but because I've heard it so many times, I just asked. It was sort of a confirmation, was this your issue? But I really enjoyed it, and he was a really nice guy, and as most of the players are. So I'm looking forward to seeing him again and to see the Lions, and who have been really interesting. So
yeah, they are. Yeah, as we sit here on Saturday, they are a couple games over 500, and they're not operating at full strength, although they're getting great production from Takeya Okawari-kun Nakamura, who hit another home run while you were asleep. So he has 6 this season. And we've seen in recent seasons, I believe, we've seen Hotaka Yamakawa just punishing pitches all over the place in the first month, 2 months of the season. He's on, you know, great pace to, or he had been on great paces in the past to maybe get to 55 home runs, maybe 60 when they, you know, factored all the, or extrapolated all the stats out across the season. But he's not there right now. He's injured. And I did see on Twitter that he played in a farm team game and was out at first base, I believe. I'm assuming it was first base. They said he was out in the field. So that's good. So he's on his way back. And then Sosuke Genda, the greatest shortstop in the world, he hasn't been out there because he had his injury from the WBC. And
yeah,
so
he started the season and then it didn't heal while he was playing, obviously.
Obviously. Yeah. So, I mean, so they're not operating at full strength. And yet, you know, guys like David McKinnon, and we did see, I'm sure you didn't even see or hear about this, but Mark Payton went up for a ball today. And just like Gakuto Wakabayashi crumpled to the ground, clutching his knee. But then he got up and he was able to walk off the field today. So I'm hoping, I didn't see any news before we started to record. So I'm hoping that he's doing okay, because he was walking fine when he came off the field. But I mean, to use your team up there in the Bay Area, the Warriors, Klay Thompson was walking around doing jumping jacks and wanted to get back into a game in which he had torn his knee up. So everybody reacts differently. Some guys have a different threshold for pain. You're jacked up in the moment with all the adrenaline flowing through you during a game. When that stuff wears off, maybe the pain comes in. I don't know, but hopefully he'll be okay. But yeah, they haven't been at full strength. But I'll tell you this, the Lions rotation is really taking on a different shape than I expected. So when we do our reshuffle of predictions that I promised we could do after a month into the season, I've always liked Wataru Matsumoto. I thought he had the makings of maybe not an ace, but a frontline starter in the top three, the first 1-2-3 guy.
He's one of those Oryx pitchers, you know, guys who got really good stuff, except you just don't see it every game.
Yeah. And then Tatsuya Imai, he finally filled out physically. I mean, before, I think if you line him up next to Pencil, you wouldn't be able to see him. And so now he's thicker in the legs. So they've been working him out, working on the physical part and getting him filled out. And now he goes deep into games and he's not max effort guy. So he looks a little bit better and he's pitching well. Kona Takahashi didn't do well today, but he has been pitching like an ace. And we heard or read somewhere he's thinking about going to the States at some point. And then Kaima Taira, who's the setup man who turned closer, who has now gone into the role of starter, and he looks good. So that rotation looks real. That's five arms of guys who can sustain over, you know, it would be if the guys that we have seen up to now can be consistent through the season, which is a big if.
Yeah, it's still early.
It's a big if. And then, of course, McKinnon and Payton have been producing, so this whole team looks good. Of course, again, when Genda comes back at short, Yamakawa comes back, I'm sure Lions fans will be thrilled. But the pen might be the one area that might be some concern, but it has been functioning adequately. I think there's some hiccups here and there, but that's you could say that about every team. So I like what I'm seeing out there. I have to go to more Lions games.
Yeah, well, that's not the hardest thing in the world to do, given our physical locations. Oh, yeah, I mean yours now, but no, I've of course the other thing about Genda being gone is the Lions did a SoftBank Hawks on us and says, oh geez, we got a short. Except it wasn't a guy who'd been hanging around in the minors 5 years trying to fight for a place at the training table. It was just they've got a rookie shortstop who looks pretty good.
Yeah. Okay.
So they have this rookie shortstop, Ryosuke Kodama, who I think he also came out of, like Genda did, came out of corporate league ball, and looks like he knows what he's doing. Looks like he can really catch the ball. So they're like going, okay, we're just going to start you at nine, but you know, don't get no ideas.
Don't get too many ideas, buddy. We need you to produce, but you don't get cozy.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we thank David, and like I said, I will be back out at the ballpark formerly known as Seibu Dome.
Of course. As I talked about the Lions, and I said it was like, you know, nobody's going to tell me what to do. And as soon as I went over and I wanted to talk to Kensuke Konda, they says, well, you're not going to talk to him when you're standing in front of the dugout like you think you're a normal reporter. Our reporters are penned up and isolated over there. So you want to talk to him, you go over there, and wear your Star of David on the arm there.
Okay.
Because we don't brook no nonsense from you media types.
You media types. All right, let's make a four-seam transition and talk about the Murakami malaise. So you and I, we discussed Munetaka Murakami of the Yakult Swallows off mic last week a little bit, and the struggles really have been continuing. And it's, I mean, I've been watching some of his at-bats, and he just, the bat is fishing. You know, he really looks like he has a reel and a fishing line, and he's just putting it up there hoping to get a little bit of contact and not strike out. He has looked pretty bad. But remember, and I said this off mic last week, he was not looking good during the warm-up games for the WBC, during the WBC. He just so happened to be able to key in on a few pitches. He had the big hit against Mexico in the semifinal and helped Japan win that game. He hit a home run in the final, as I recall.
Yeah, he tied it 1-1.
And but he came back to Japan and he got off the plane in struggle land, and he has not been able to find his way.
Hey,
there's no GPS.
This didn't start this year. This started in September last year.
Okay.
After he hit his 55th home run, he basically went into a funk. He hit one home run and he did a little bit in the Japan series, but he's basically been in a funk since he hit his 55th home run. So it's been
56?
No, 55th. 55th? He was 56th on the last day of the season.
Okay.
Like a week after, a week, 9 days after he was 55th, and did, you know, he was the guy we're looking at now.
That's interesting, because I was thinking, well, part of this might be just the mental adjustment of, because I've done it. I played in a tournament that was a national tournament. You know, my team, we went to the final, we won, we came back, and then all of a sudden you have to play a regular, not meaningless, but not a tournament game. It's mm-hmm. just your regular old game. And it's a really significant mental shift that you mm-hmm. have to make, turning your approach from, okay, every swing, every at bat counts so much, to, we'll get them tomorrow. You know, because we do have a game tomorrow. It's not monumental for us to get through this game. We will have a game tomorrow regardless. So that mental shift, like I said, is really a challenge. And so I was thinking it might be somewhat mental, but I'm watching, like I said, you watch baseball players' feet, and his feet are bad. The bat is bad. The eyes are bad. He's just not in a good mental space right now. And I don't know what Yakult does. That team lost its seventh consecutive game tonight. And part of that was they got Shoki Murakami'd, and this was a different Murakami malaise. Because this guy is not giving up any runs to anybody. I think he has 24 consecutive scoreless innings to start the season as a starting pitcher. Just ridiculous. So congratulations to Hanshin Tigers. They've got the next Sawamura Award winner already. But what did you see before when he started struggling in September, and what are you seeing now, and what do you think? Three questions there.
What was I seeing in September? Well, that's
you're just seeing bad at best.
Yeah, I was seeing a little overeagerness. I was seeing, you know, I want to get this home run. He was trying to hit home runs a lot. I think right now he'd be happy if he went up there and hit the ball hard. I mean, he has been on occasion hitting the ball hard. You know, he swings hard, but his timing is completely messed up, because he's basically, the pitches he's hit have been like really, really fat ones, and anything good. And I mean, stuff that last year, I mean, I'm seeing pitches. This is what I'm seeing. I'm not really seeing his swing mechanics as much, but I'm seeing pitches that last year you would have said, you know, get your glove ready in right field.
Don't get your glove ready.
And I'm seeing like missing it by a foot.
Yeah.
And not even close.
Fishing. He's fishing. Well, he has 37 strikeouts. I'm not sure if this Yahoo site has been updated with tonight's stats. Probably not. So 37 leads Japan in strikeouts, and right behind him is Aristides Aquino of the Dragons with 31. And I bet since that was a day game, he's probably have been updated. And the numbers are just, they're just dog ugly for Murakami. He's down near the bottom of both leagues in batting average. His OPS is 5-something. I mean, these are just incredible numbers for a guy who we all expected to do a lot more than this, obviously. But yeah, the struggles are real. And I don't, if I'm the manager, I suppose I sit him down for a couple of days and just, you know, let him get his head out of it. But what if he doesn't recover after that? What do you do?
I don't know.
I'm glad I don't have a solution.
I think obviously, like I said, and I said last time, there is a possibility that he's having an injury. Maybe he even doesn't even know he has an injury. Maybe it's something, you know, that something's tighter or something is throwing him off. And the reason I say that is because I've seen analysis since the pitch tracking era has begun. I've seen analysts find that suddenly when you have a guy who normally hits a pitch and he doesn't, when suddenly there's something happens where he's not hitting and it's because he's not getting to this pitch or that pitch that he normally would, that sometimes later on they're finding injuries. And so I don't think that's an impossibility. I don't think it's the reason, but I think that is a possibility. What do you do? I do not have a clue. I think what you do is just let him sit in there and play every day until, well, I think, yeah, sitting him down one day is probably a good idea. Just sort of like, you know, just take it, just relax for a day.
Sure.
Now, it helped him, obviously, in the WBC, it helped him to not be batting fourth. It helped him take a little of that. I'm assuming this was a pressure thing. That part of it, you know, so part of it is the pressure of he feels, and here is my I haven't done any pseudo psychoanalysis in a couple of weeks, so it's, I guess, I'm overdue.
All right, Dr. Jim.
Yeah, so you know, the expectations are really high on him, and I think when the WBC, when they moved him out of number fourth, he said, I really hate it not being in the fourth spot because that was my spot. And but he instantly perked up and got something, you know, he got hits as soon as they pushed him, put him sixth, then put him fifth. He instantly got hits. He hasn't gotten better, but I think that's a tiny bit of it. I don't think it's the whole thing, but I think there's a tiny bit of that is the pressure. And so taking him out of, you know, sitting him down for a day, which I would prefer not to do, but it may, you know, batting him, letting Osuna bat fourth and letting him bat fifth one day might do a little of that, but it ain't going to fix what's wrong, because I don't think that was the main problem in the WBC. Might have been a bigger problem, but I don't think that's his big problem now. He's so good that, you know, the big question is, at what point is failure going to crush his confidence and ruin him? You know, that's really the big question, because you keep him in the lineup as long as it's not going to permanently damage him. And I don't think it's going to. So my thing is just keep him in the lineup. You know, maybe bat him fifth one day, but, you know, put him back and forth and just let him work out the troubles, because this team's got lots of troubles and he ain't helping the team. But he could be hitting really well and they'd still be playing badly. Because this team is it's just too banged up and not there.
And that's why I brought up the fact that the team has lost 7 consecutive games. And I think that's important, because at some point somebody has to step up and take some responsibility about, you know, in terms of, okay, well, if it's the manager, for instance, and he's going to say, well, look, I've got to sit this player down. He's not performing well.
Yep.
Or someone's got to say, well, you know what, I'm the one who's causing problems in the lineup. I'll go down to the farm, or and this is stuff we're not going to be privy to, but somebody's gonna do something and make a move and say something, I think. And it's with the losing, because if the team is winning, it's not so bad. They can carry somebody who's not doing
as they,
well.
As they were the first 2 weeks of the season. So.
Sure. And I'm looking now at the stats that are updated on the app, and Murakami's batting average is down to 148. But before the day, he was at 156, and that's not even the lowest on his team. Hideki Nagaoka was a little bit behind him and went 0-for-2 tonight, so he's still behind. And this is at the very bottom of the stack of batters at the in the Central League who have minimum. It doesn't have a minimum for how many at-bats. But anyway, Murakami, 589 OPS, his on-base average, 273. His slugging percentage 273, on base average 316. It's just not good. So I'm not expecting him to be out of the lineup or anything, but I certainly would sit him down for a day. I don't think they're going to send him to the minors to get better, but he's their big horse. So we're talking about a batting champ, a triple crown winner last year. Home run king in 21 and 22, RBI king, and obviously last year when he won the triple crown, this guy can play, and he's still 23, just turned 23. So how much patience does the entire team have to have? I don't know, as much as it takes.
Yeah, exactly. Now, but I, you know, there's a really interesting question, because it's one of the multitude of things about which I never shut up. Is the don't laugh too hard.
Does this thing have a mute button?
I got one. Is the managers, the new wave of managers, Shingo Takatsu and Satoshi Nakajima and Akira Yano, and formerly Hatsuhiko Tsuji. And I have to think, This is a question where it collides with what, you know, the standard is: if you're not producing, you're not playing.
Mm-hmm.
Or so if you're not, so that's that. Just that's just the way it goes. And the I know you can do it, so I'm going to let you do it, which is the Swallows thing. But on the other hand, you get to players like Hideki Matsui, and you get to players like Shohei Ohtani and Munetaka Murakami and Yuki Yanagita, where at some point they get to points where they are not themselves. They are not the guys who are normally there. And with the exception of Hideki Matsui, because it was the Giants, and the Giants were required to do dumb things. If doing the smart thing is bad for the corporate image.
Hashtag okay. I hate.
So Matsui was never going to come out of the number four spot. They would, let him and he'd figure it out. So he's going to figure it out. But if you asked the other managers of this group, Tsuji and Yano and Satoshi Nakajima, if you think he was playing for their team, I would say he would already have been moved around in the lineup because we've seen their big horses get moved around when they weren't doing it. Tsuji maybe not, because Yamakawa was pretty much, he had his spot. He pretty much had to get hurt to be out of the lineup, to be out of the cleanup spot. But Tsuji maybe not, but with Yano and Nakajima, he definitely would have been moved. So that's an interesting case, is how, because the Swallows too have a reputation of, we know you can do it, so do it.
Right.
We're not going to wail on you because you went, you had one hit in 30 at bats, because that happens to everybody at some point.
Interesting. Well, it would be fun to keep an eye on it, and I'll be watching every move. Let's make a two-seam transition and talk about everyone's favorite pitcher, Roki Sasaki, and go rocking with Roki. Now, although we might have to
I thought my favorite pitcher was Shoki Murakami all of a sudden. Okay, what's up with that?
Okay, all right. It's fluid.
Rocking with
fluid.
Shoki. Okay.
Not showing with Shoki. We might have to change the name to Rocky Roki this week, though, because on Friday night at Kyocera Dome Osaka, he was not great early on. And it came to me, this is the site at which he had that run-in with the umpire Kazuyuki she died down there in Osaka a couple years ago.
Last year? Yep, it was last April. It was the game after he threw his 8 perfect innings.
Okay, all right. And so he doesn't seem to pitch well there, though, all the time. And he didn't pitch, you know, the game was a 4-3 Marines win over Oryx in 10 innings, so he didn't get a decision. He matched Shohei Ohtani's 2016 record for fastest pitch in MPB through 165, which is 102 miles an hour, and he hit that 4 times in the game. But Sasaki came into the game and he had thrown 20 scoreless innings to start the season. He had allowed 5 hits over the 3 starts and surrendered 7 in 6 innings pitched on this night. And then he had 8 strikeouts with a walk and 2 hit batters, including hitting Tomoyo Mori and sending the guy down to the ground so fast you thought the Grim Reaper just used that staff and snatched him down to the ground. But Mori actually stayed in the game, came back out and ran. So he didn't look great, did Sasaki? He was, I don't know what was happening. He was too much around the heart of the play. I think the last outing I said he threw too many strikes. He was throwing too many strikes.
That was noticeable last week. And my take on that last week, having actually watched that game, was he was trying to throw into the ninth inning by throwing balls in the zone and getting quick outs.
Mm. Yeah, well, the fork ball, which you've talked about it not being great, was not great. Okay. And he again wasn't able to locate it at times. Sometimes it just floated in there right in the heart of the plate, and that's what Mori hit early for his double. And it just wasn't a great outing for him. Marwin Gonzalez, he was batting from the left side, and I thought I noticed him having some trouble with left-handers or lefty hitters this night. And in one of the innings in which the Oryx Buffalo scored, Gonzalez hit this little twisty liner toward third that hit the turf and spun away from Hisanori Yasuda and, you know, ended up being an infield hit. And then one of the harder hit balls by this developmental player turned regular contract guy, Tokumasa Chano, he hits a shot up the middle that bounced off Sasaki. I think it hit his left cleat and then the bottom of his right cleat or foot. And but it was probably going to go up the middle. I think they were cheating over into the hole in the, you know, up the middle. They might have gotten to it, but it was hit pretty hard. So I was thinking that was going to be a hit too, but who knows? It hit him. So it hit Sasaki. So it never got through. So I mean, they didn't really hit the ball out of the outfield into the outfield in this particular inning. But again, he just didn't look great. He ends up, like I said, hitting this milestone with the fastest pitch. And that's what a lot of people wanted to come away talking about. And I'm like, yeah, but in the meantime, he wasn't great. Now, he held Oryx to 3 runs, got and he escaped with a no decision. But it reminded me of the 2013 Masahiro Tanaka kind of run where Tanaka would, even if he gave up a run sometime during the game, because what did he do? He went 24-0 that season.
Correct.
And
all the games that he didn't win, he threw quality starts.
Quality starts, yeah. So this was a quality start, but it comes with the big caveat that he just wasn't sharp. And yeah, the hitting the speed mark is great. But he's just struggled through the whole outing. He just never seemed comfortable, never seemed to be in control of what was going on. And like I said, ended up hitting Mori, got out of that inning, but he's coming off the mound shaking his head like, geez, why does life have to be so difficult sometimes? I'm like, kid, you got it good, man. You're not losing.
Yeah.
Because the Marines came back and scored for him and got him even, and he kept it even and then left the game.
Yeah. So he's had, as you said, he's had it easy. He has it easy because of his tremendous physical talent in that respect. And so, you know, he has it easy in that when he puts in the effort that everybody else puts in, he's got a little more room for error. But one of the things, and you know, I'll harp again, this is another thing about which I declined to be quiet about, is, you know, his physical development was, his body is immature for somebody his age.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is still an issue. And I think he badly wants to catch up with the rest of the guys. He's like the first year, the new guy who's really good, but he's still not one of the older guys. Even doesn't matter how good he is, he's still not one of the older kids. And he's, you know, he's like, his bicycle might even still have training wheels on it. He's trying to catch up with the big kids.
The big kids, yeah.
And, you know, this year the goal is for him to pitch every game, you know, to stay in the rotation the whole year, which he didn't get anything. You know, last year the goal was for him to pitch regularly in the rotation. Mm-hmm. And this year is to pitch every, you know, to stay in the rotation for virtually the entire year. And so we're seeing him making, or at least I'm interpreting what he's doing is making adjustments to meet those goals. So I think he's fishing a little bit for what's the most efficient pitcher that will get him where he wants to go. And that wasn't it. And I think he's trying to stretch himself out a little bit in terms of going deeper in games and trying to find out what works. In which case, he reminds me a little bit of Masahiro Tanaka, like in 2011, when he had that marvelous year. But you'd see he was like, actually it was before he had his 2011, his massive 2011 year. He was like always trying to figure out things and find new ways to be better. And I think this is sort of a little bit what Roki's doing. And Roki Sasaki, we're not on first name basis. Mm-hmm. But I think this is a little bit what he's doing. I thought that was obvious last week. I thought we saw a lot of that last year as he adjusted to not just being a hard thrower, to trying to be more of a pitcher as the season went on. Because at the beginning of the season, he was throwing 164 every game. And he's, mm-hmm. you know, hitting it 5-6 times. And by the middle of the summer, he probably would hit about 162 early in the game, and that would be that. So we saw all kinds of little changes, but again, this is normal. I mean, this is normal. Nobody's a robot. Everybody comes out and they're in different physical form, and so he's also dealing with something he's never dealt with, which pitching week after week, and it's not normal for him, and he's trying to make it normal. So that this happened, that he was, you know, the big question for me for him is not will he be better, but will he. He needs to find that routine where he's not, obviously, where he's not anywhere near his best in terms of strength and command, and find that. I think he's looking for that gear. He's looking for that second gear, that lower gear that he can exist in when the top gear isn't exactly working. Although top gear implies speed, and obviously speed wasn't his problem. Mm-hmm. And although speed is rarely his problem, but very often you'll see the fastest pitch he throws in a game get really hammered.
Right. So yeah, like I said, he had come in, he had allowed 5 hits over 3 starts, and he had surrendered 7 hits in 6 innings. On this night, he finished going 7 innings, but you know, struggled.
He allowed eight hits in 7 innings. Yeah.
So, and the pitch, you know, again, it was pitch number 72 he threw to Yutaro Sugimoto, where he tied Otani's record. And
that's different, because typically he threw his hardest in the first inning.
Yeah, I've seen that too. And it wasn't really a max effort, but you could see him gear up to try to, you know, put some extra sauce on that fastball. And I think Sugimoto saw it too, or recognized it, and that's why he was able to get a bat on it. But hopefully he'll have a better start. Sasaki will next time out, and we'll revisit next week and see how he's doing. Now for our players of the month, our top performers for the first month plus of the season. Of course, we've got the last day of the month tomorrow, but we're going to just jump ahead.
If we don't talk about it, it doesn't happen.
It doesn't happen. All right.
That's it. If you have worked at Yomiuri, you know it's true.
That's right. Not an assassination. Anyway,
what was the protest? Those people in the streets.
All right, let's go hitter in the Central League. I think the candidates are Toshiro Miyazaki of the Bay Stars, Koji Chikamoto of the Hanshin Tigers, probably the two best guys. Taiki Sekine of the Bay Stars probably gets an honorable mention, and Shogo Akiyama of the Carp is hanging in there. What do you got?
Well, Shogo Akiyama of the Carp is doing what Shogo Akiyama of the Lions did, and get a lot of hits.
Yeah.
My Miyazaki, though, I think it's just silly what a great month he had. And this is a very unusual thing for him, because he's kind of one of those guys, he just sort of plugs along, and I'm not used to seeing him. Wow, second home run in 3 days and third home run in 5 days. And I'm going, what is up with this guy?
Yeah, he seems healthy to me. That's what's probably up mostly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's built differently, and I like him. He's seems like a really level-headed guy. I think he was probably no, and as much as Alex Ramirez really liked him as a hitter, when he was probably, there was probably nobody on the Bay Stars team who was happier when Alex Ramirez wasn't the manager anymore. Okay. Just for a variety of Alex Ramirez reasons.
Okay. Well, I was thinking that there were, you know, Maki was gone for WBC duty, Soto was gone for WBC duty, Miyazaki probably got a lot of swings in the spring, and because I pictured him as kind of a slow starter. I think the 1 year recently that I remember him not being a slow starter is I think he won a batting title that year.
Mm-hmm.
And that was about it. I just don't remember him being very productive right out of the chute. So that's what I was thinking. But yeah, 458 as we go into, I believe this is before Saturday's games, and it has four home runs, and OPS is 12, almost 1300. So, I mean, yeah, he's not doing too poorly. So I think it's him. Although Koji Chikamoto, I think, has done what he can do. He's not a home run hitter. Yet he has a couple of home runs. His OPS is 842, which is pretty high for him, if you ask me. And both of his home runs, he hit a home run at Nagoya Dome and one at Koshien. And those are not home run friendly ballparks. So maybe he has the power surge going a little bit here this year. Okay, what about pitchers?
The Central League is really hard.
Yes.
I got three. I sort of winnowed it down to three guys, but I think it's really...
I bet we only overlap on two of them.
Yeah, probably, because there was a half a dozen of them. The guy, I'll skip straight to the top and go with the guy I picked, who is Raydel Martinez. 7 saves, 1 hold in 8 games, 2 hits and no walks, and 11 strikeouts.
You stole my guy!
I apologize.
I didn't think you'd go and look for the reliever. I just thought
I didn't steal him, he defected.
Hashtag high.
Good one. I hope there's no more of that. The poor Dragons, the poor Dragons.
I've been looking at Foster Griffin, who struck out 23 guys and 22 and two-thirds innings with
didn't strike out 22 guys. He struck out probably 18 Dragons in that.
That's true. I keep forgetting.
He faced them twice. As real.
I forgot to adjust my calculations for Dragons only count for half. Okay.
Are you going to give them half? You going that high?
I do. They're professional hit. They're ostensibly professional hitters. And I had Alan Curry, who is 0.68 ADRA, 3-1 and doing okay. I think he also made fun of the Dragons a bit too. So maybe that's not.
Who doesn't?
but Raydel Martinez, unfortunately, doesn't get the pitch against his teammates.
Now, wait a minute. That's the argument that I used for a long time about the Bay Stars hitters. They don't get to hit against their own pitchers. You cannot. And then you always used to, again, chiding me for that, saying that's not nice, that's not fair, that's not true. But here you are using that argument. So
it wasn't an argument, it was a joke.
Oh, a joke. Okay. I also had Cy Snead up there because, but he faced the Dragons twice. So I'm not sure how, that's why I put him at number three there. But a bunch of guys who won three games. And we always try to guess what this committee or what this group is going to do in terms of choosing. And I don't know. I think you and I would go with Alan Cudi of the Carp because he had such a spectacular start. He has had such a spectacular start, and he had thrown, I think it was 19 consecutive scoreless innings, gave up some runs the other day, but he has had a good start. So I'm going to say they're going to give Cudi the nod here, even though he doesn't have the wins to go with it.
You know, the only thing I have to say about Alan Cudi, and I'm excited, you know, if we're going to be on the field and get to talk to people, he's one of the people I really want to talk to because he's one of the handful of guys will come up and say hi to me before I see him.
Oh.
And so there's always that. And he has been through a couple of iterations he's got a big frame and he's been trying to figure out how to manage it. And in 2022 in spring training, the story was about all the pitches he was throwing in bullpens. He was, he was going to be the next Hiroki Kuroda and throw his, you know, he threw a 250 pitch bullpen and that was going to be the new thing. And then this year, the news was he's going MLB, all MLB style on us, and he's throwing 20 pitch bullpens. So I'm keen because when he modified his pitching form with the help of Jay Jackson, his former teammate Jay Jackson, because he said basically, you know, you're a big guy and you got big long limbs and you pretty much need to do different from every other Japanese pitcher. Which is actually every other Japanese pitcher is different anyway, but he wanted to choose a different kind of model. It's interesting to see where he is this year.
Well, I take it back. He only has the one win, and I know they're not going to give it to a guy with one win. They're probably going to give it to Kotaro Otake. But,
could be. He went 3-0. He didn't pitch many innings.
No, but they don't care, right?
Well, who knows? But the thing is, they also look at the ERA qualifiers.
Mm.
So if you're not on the list, like Otake isn't, then he might not be. Although although to be honest, I think if I had to pick a Central League pitcher of the month, I mean, based on what they did, it would really be hard for me not to pick Shoki Murakami.
Yeah, now, especially after he goes tonight and throws eight more scoreless innings. So, all right, it should be fun. I like Martinez as well. I thought he has been really sharp. He has been better than before. But, of course, he's got a lot of pressure because you blow a game with that team, it's like blowing three. What about the Pacific League, the batters? I got Tomoyo Mori of the Oryx Buffaloes, and I have Shuta Tonosaki of the Cebu Lions.
I had three. Well, I had Tomio Mori. He was my number one. But I had Takeya Nakamura and Shuta Tonosaki of the Lions right behind him. Which is the court of interesting because a year ago they were all three Cebu Lions.
Yeah. Yes, they were. So that would be a formidable team this season. But I like what Mori is doing. Again, he took a Roki Sasaki fastball off the I guess it was just above the knee on the back side of his right leg. So yeah, we'll see how the next week goes for him. But he only has to play one more day in this month, and I think he's probably the guy. What about pitchers?
This was regardless of what he did on Friday, it's got to be Roki Sasaki. Kona Takahashi, you got to give him credit. I don't know if I mentioned it last week, but when I went to Tokyo Dome and saw the Lions, I had wanted to speak to Kona Takahashi and but just before the beginning of the game, just while the Hawks were batting, he came out and he was chatting with Yuki and Nagita. And those two guys, you know, Yanagi is kind of he's a bigger guy and big shoulders, not massive, not Shohei Ohtani built, but Kona Takahashi is really jacked right now. He's a really big, powerful guy. He's not that skinny kid I remember from 2017 or nothing anymore. So, wow.
Yeah. When I was talking to Dietrich Enns, he walked by and said hi. I think he kind of remembered me from the before time. So he said hi, and I'm like, yeah, dude, your hair, you and your hair, and Tatsuya Imai, your hair. You guys are twinning up the hair thing here. But yeah, I got Sasaki too. I think it's kind of a no brainer. I think he's going to walk away with this. But I wanted to give some shout outs to a couple of guys. One is Kenya Suzuki, a submariner with the Fighters, and he throws this little float ball that's so slow. I remember I'm saying this about Nobuyuki Hoshino. He used to throw these little float pitches as this tall, lanky left-hander. And I thought, I heard a coach in the United States say this before. He says, well, he throws the ball so slow that if he doesn't like where it's going, he can run and catch it and go back to the mound and throw it again. That's the way this submariner, Kenya Suzuki, throws. Just little floaters, and nobody can wait on him. And when they have him timed up, then he throws something else. So he has done well. And then Shunpeita Yamashita of Oryx, you talked about him earlier. A kid he's already got the physical attributes at 20. Big legs, big thighs. He's tall. He throws hard, but he has been an off-speed magician out there at 20, not trying to overpower people.
And that curveball. Wow.
Yeah. So
I swear I'm going to be surprised if I think I would be a little surprised if Yoshinobu Yamamoto doesn't go like asking him how to throw a curveball. And this is the guy with the best curveball in Japan.
Yeah.
Because that is just a beauty. I mean, there's one of the things in baseball there's a couple of things that I really love, and that is like the perfect bunt, the absolute perfect bunt, and an absolute perfect curveball. And this guy has an absolute perfect curveball.
All right, enough said. Let's go to fielding questions. All right, Brian, thank you for waiting. This one comes to us from Brian. He's in Shizuoka Prefecture, and he sent it by email. And he says, thanks for the great JBW podcasts. I've been enjoying
them.
Thank you, sir, very much for saying the kind words. He says, I wanted to let you know that I especially dig the hashtag high heat drop. So I guess it's that sound drop that he likes when I made that up for Jim for his zingers. Of course, I had some zingers too, but Jim was always throwing out these zingers, and I always felt like it was too empty to just to listen to me laugh. So I made that drop for him. So yeah. And he has been firing them up through the years ever since I made it. So I'm glad you like it. Brian says, I wanted to hear your thoughts about expansion for NPB. I know people have talked about this recently, but it seems like after the WBC and the amount of interest it generated, maybe now would be the best time to move forward with expansion plans. Do you think expansion would be a good thing? And if you had to pick four places to receive a team, where would you put them? Whew. All right. So once every other year, this is year 13 of the show. So I think we've gotten maybe four or five questions about expansion. And every time up to now, I've been saying, I don't think it's possible. I'm starting to lean a different direction. I don't know if it's, soon, but I think it might be possible. But what do you think? I want to hear what you think first.
Well, I just wrote about this actually at some length on my blog, on my website Monday, the 24th of April, about where Japanese baseball goes from here. And I'm not going to summarize that whole thing, but I will say, I think baseball, it is possible, but first what's required is that Japanese baseball owners decide they need to change the way they think about their business. And what I mean that is they have these gold mines. They're sitting on they've each of them have the goose that lays the golden egg.
Mm-hmm.
And they're basically looking at that bird to figure out, you know, they're using it to get feathers from, because that's their model. And the model for the historic model for Japanese baseball is as advertising for the parent company and not a moneymaker. But they're in so well positioned to make money if they decided that that's what they, that was. But the problem with that is what they're doing works for them. Mm-hmm. They've achieved the goal of having their team serve as advertising engines for their parent companies, even though it's not what it could be. They're where MLB was in 1973 before free agency. You know, we don't have to pay labor costs, so we sell tickets and we're good. We don't make much money, but that's not the point. And see, the MLB, so there's that. So that's number one, is they have to have a sort of a mind change, an attitude adjustment. But if they do, expansion certainly could happen. And I think there are lots of places, there are lots of markets that could be developed. I think the two biggest markets that would be the two easiest to develop would be in Niigata and Shizuoka. We're going to have minor league, where NPB is planning minor league expansion next year, which is, I'm surprised, has not gotten more news. And Shizuoka is one of the places where some investors have raised their hand and say they're going to, the Japan is planning to add an extra team to the Eastern and Western leagues next year. And that will be interesting. That'll be a start. Taiwan's professional baseball has gone that route. They make new teams start out in the minors for a year.
Mm-hmm.
And so they've gone from four, I think they're at six now, or maybe the sixth team is now in the minors. I don't remember. But there's that. But the other thing they need to do to expand is they need to get rid of, they need to have more minor leagues. They need more and more minor leagues to increase the player pool. And anybody who says there isn't enough talent, that all the time, we know that's not true. We know that's not true, because when NPB said there wasn't enough talent with 12 teams with 70-man rosters, they added the developmental system. And the Hawks, half the Hawks lineup were guys who were not taken in the draft.
Yeah.
So we've got a championship caliber team where many of the best players were not considered good enough to play in NPB.
Mm-hmm.
So there is the talent, but it needs to be developed. And the last thing they need to do is they need to get rid of the limit on players who are not born in Japan and who have not played amateur ball in Japan, the restrictions on import players. Because as soon as you lift that restriction, there's plenty of players. You know, there's plenty of players, and there'll still be more jobs for Japanese players, and there'll still be more jobs for Japanese coaches.
Yeah, if you can play and you can hit and you can pitch and you can coach, you'll get a job.
And the other two things is, yeah, okay, there's two teams in Tokyo. There could probably be three teams in Tokyo. There could probably be three teams in Osaka. There could probably be two teams in Fukuoka and two teams in Nagoya. Again, these have to be developed. They have to have parks. The teams would have to own their own parks, which is Japanese teams don't like to do, because it doesn't match their business model. But yeah, I think it can happen. Whether it will is very unlikely, because I don't see Japanese baseball owners thinking that they need to do anything more than what they already think they're succeeding or failing at.
Yeah, as long as they're making money, well, they're not going to change. Yeah, I was thinking about the fact that we have this imbalance in the farm systems throughout NPB. Some teams mm-hmm. have two levels of farm teams, and most teams just have one. And that we first need to get a uniform system that in that aspect, whether it's limiting the number of teams, because as far as you told me before, your developmental players, you can have almost as many as sure. you want, but you sure. can fill up a team.
Hawks, yeah, I think the Hawks have 30 now.
Yeah. So we need uniform decisions and on how to structure that aspect of the game. And then once you have that, then I think we can talk about forming other teams. But I'm open to it, but I'm still not sure about how they go about it, because Do you add two teams? You add one team to each league and have an imbalanced schedule and then start playing more interleague games to get those teams going? Do you add two teams to one league and then later on and then add two more teams to the other league at a later date sometime? I mean,
I think that's the answer.
I think it is, but I think those things have to be worked out, and it has to be.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. It has to make sense, because now you're lessening the amount of essentially the chances for one team in this league with more teams to get to the Japan Series. There's more layers because you have more teams. And I know, yeah, they're going to play the same amount of games, but basically let's say they put two teams in the Central League. Now you have to get through seven other teams to get to the Japan Series, whereas in the other league, they still only have to get through five teams to get to the Japan Series. So right. I don't know how that works.
That's a good one. And that, you know, there's a really good point to that. And I think the key to a lot of these changes is, not surprisingly, the Yomiuri Giants.
As it always seems to come down to.
For some reason, and the reason, and I'll mention this for two things. One, if you pointed out to the Giants what happened in the American League, when the American League became larger than the National League a couple of times, the quality of play, there's kind of a statistical analysis. There's a game you can play where basically the teams get better. You have to be better to mm-hmm. win. Mm-hmm. And I think that appeals to the Giants' narcissism, mm-hmm. their belief that they'll always be the best team.
Right.
Okay, so there's that. So actually, you can objectively prove that if the Central League team were to go first and add two teams, they would probably be able to have a better chance of achieving parity with the Pacific League than if they let the Pacific League go first. Okay, so that's one thing. And the other thing, way this helps with the Giants, is the part to do with removing the restrictions on import players. Right now, the Giants last year, they outbid MLB teams for a couple of 16-year-old Dominican amateurs.
Mm-hmm.
They outbid because MLB teams are restricted to how much they can pay. And when they decided not to pay that much, then the Giants jumped in and said, oh, they were going to give you this, we'll give it to you. So if those two kids, a shortstop and an outfielder, I think, if those two young men turn out to be viable stars, then that's a way for the Giants to say, well, you know, maybe this import player thing is past its sell-by date. If those two Dominican, you know, they'll say, we've got a talent route. You know, we can afford to pay anything we want. We can outbid every team on the planet, except the SoftBank Hawks. But, you know, they're in the Pacific League, so who cares? Yeah. So, but if the Giants think that the best thing going forward is to get rid of the restriction on import players, then that could happen. And if that happens, and if they think the league's expansion will work in their favor, then it could happen.
Right.
But of course, the downside is the Giants think this whole system was built for us, so why should we touch it? So I don't know. I don't know the answer to any of those questions, but I think it's really interesting.
Yeah, it is. It is. And just before we go, I know these cities that might be host cities for these teams, you have to have infrastructure, you have to have transport, you have to have then you set up a population base. It's not only about having the players and the ability, because you say two teams in Nagoya. I lived there for 12 years. I could see it, but what I could see better is a team in Nagano, or like you said, Niigata. So Brian asked us for locations. I would do the easiest sites that we could do right off the bat, and that would be Miyazaki and Okinawa, and then Matsuyama, where there's a stadium, a really nice stadium. You said Niigata, I say Nagano as well. You got a cold area, but anywhere where the Shinkansen stops and it's not, you can build a stadium that's not too far so that the teams can get there easily without having to fly. That's what you're looking for in terms of infrastructure, and then the population, and then go from there and build from the inside out. But it's a great question. Like I said, we've gotten it a few times and I just shot it down in the past, but I'm starting to think that because I have also heard the rumblings, and I think Japan wants to expand. It's going to take a lot of planning and a lot of smart guys figuring out how to do it and how to make it happen and cooperating.
Yeah. And so often Japanese baseball is about a bunch of smart guys figuring out why they shouldn't do things and how to fix the old model that probably should be scrapped. But I mean, I started thinking about this because, and I mentioned MLB because of something that Robert Whiting wrote about how much, you know, if you looked at MLB in 1973 and Japan in 73, they were essentially, they were twins. They had teams that weren't making a lot of money. They had teams that weren't drawing big crowds, and they were on an absolute par. And Japan had, you know, the population, the ratio to teams to population was a little different, but it wasn't that far. And then suddenly what happened was free agency wiped out the plan that they didn't want to break. And Japan needs to realize that they need to break the system that they think is working, but could work a lot better. And I just don't see any of these owners thinking, I can't see the Chunichi Dragon saying, oh, what, you want us to like make a business out of this? Are you kidding us? That requires investment. We're not into it to invest money. We're into it to people to pay us to put advertising, you know, pay us to do stuff with them.
All right. Great question, Brian. Thank you so much. Yep. Anyone else who has a question, hit us up on Twitter at JBW Podcast with the hashtag High Heat. Send questions by email to yakyujohn@gmail.com. Hit us up on the Facebook page. Leave us a message, a comment, question, anything you want there. Look for us on Google Podcasts and iTunes. We will talk to you next week. You going to be back?
Yeah, I will. I will be back.
All right. Well, we'll see you next week. Enjoy your baseball.
See you then, and see you at the ballparks.
Follow the hosts on Twitter at JBW Podcast and at JBallAllen. And feel free to submit your questions by email or tweet with hashtag High Heat. Thank you for listening to Japan Baseball Weekly.